and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, physician and best-selling author Dr. Gabor Mate. His talk entitled The Hungry Ghost, A Biopsychosocial Perspective on Addiction, From Heroin to Workaholism, was recorded at the Alaska Health Summit on January 15th.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Jennifer Meyer, the past president of the Alaska Public Health Association. And if you don't know me, please come up sometime today and say hello. I'd love to meet you. I have the great honor of introducing our first speaker this morning. Dr. Mate joins us from Vancouver. We're glad that he's here. There he ran a popular family practice for over two decades. He's also worked in palliative care and more recently in Vancouver's downtown Eastside neighborhood with clients suffering from drug addiction, mental illness, and HIV. Many of you are probably familiar with his books. He's written four books. They're all Canadian bestsellers, and they've been published in nearly 20 languages and are for sale on five continents. So without further ado this morning, so we can get right into the discussion, again, please join me in welcoming Dr. Mate.
Thank you very much. I'll begin speaking here. I may end up grabbing the handheld mic if I find myself too distant from the audience. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I know that many of you are frontline healthcare workers, and this morning's subject, which is that of addiction, is very salient, I'm sure, amongst the problems that you confront in your daily rounds. Now, I worked, as mentioned in the introduction, 12 years in what is North America's most concentrated area of drug use, which is the downtown east side, the notorious downtown east side of Vancouver, where within a few block radius, we have thousands of people dependent on mostly injectable drugs, heroin, cocaine, crystal meth, but also its various other, these drugs have many other permutations, and my patients would take all of them, in addition, of course, to alcohol, cigarettes, marijuana, and other substances. The death rate is very high in that population. People tend not to live past their 40s or 50s. They die of HIV, hepatitis C, the complications of these conditions, infections induced by drug injection, brain abscesses, abscesses of the spinal cord, heart valve infections, endocarditis, suicide, violence, and accidental deaths. The second chapter of my book, which is on addiction, which is entitled In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, opens at a funeral home where a patient of mine who's 35 had died of an overdose and is now being memorialized. I will not read the details of the service, but afterwards, some of the staff who attended the funeral and the person, whose name is Shannon, her fellow addicted residents of the facility where I worked, are gathered in the parking lot. I look at this small cluster of human beings gathered at the funeral of a comrade who met her death in her mid-30s. How powerful the addiction, I think, that not all the physical disease and pain and psychological torment can shake loose its lethal hold on their souls. How powerful the drug addiction. Nothing sways them from their habit. Not illness, not the sacrifice of love and relationship, not the loss of all earthly goods, not the crushing of their dignity, not the fear of dying. The drive is that relentless. How to understand the death grip of drug addiction? What keeps Penny injecting, despite the spinal abscesses that nearly made her paraplegic? Why can't Beverly give up shooting cocaine, despite the HIV? The recurrent abscesses have had to drain on her body, and the joint infections that repeatedly put her in hospital. Well, the North American answer to that question comes down to two perspectives. First of all, the dominant mainstream perspective is that addictions are a matter of choice. So people are choosing to engage in this lifestyle, and as a result, they suffer. Now, if you believe that something is a matter of choice, then you do what the legal system does, which is you try and deter that choice, or if unsuccessful, then you punish people for having made that choice. And hence we have the war on drugs. And hence we have hundreds of thousands of people in jails because of their engagement with drugs. Because we believe that they've made a choice. The second belief that dominates medical thinking is that addictions are a matter of a disease. It's a disease of the brain. And if you ask, well, what is the source of the disease, mostly you'll be told that it's genetic. So people inherit the tendency to be addicted, and that explains their brain disease. Now, you'll notice, too, that these two perspectives share something in common. They're different. The disease perspective, and that it's a genetic illness, at least you're not blaming people. At least you're not blaming people for having inherited or passed on certain genes. But what they both have in common, but both the choice perspective and the genetic perspective do share, is that they both take society off the hook. In other words, whether it's a matter of individual choice or whether it's genes that you inherited, you don't have to look at people's conditions. You don't have to look at the social circumstances that may engender addiction. You don't have to look at people's lives. You don't have to ask what happened to this individual in this life that perhaps created the tendency towards addiction. You don't have to look at social programs. You don't have to look at the history of the Aboriginal population in Canada or the United States. Now, there's an interesting fact about Aboriginal population, and many of you work with such a population, I'm sure, is that prior to the coming of the Caucasians to North America, there were potentially addictive substances here. There was alcoholic spirits in some areas of North America. There was certainly tobacco. There was peyote. There were all kinds of psychedelic plants. But there was no known history of addiction. And it's not because these substances were not known to the natives. They were not only known to them, they were used by them. But how were they used? They were used ceremonially in spiritual practices, which is just the opposite of addictive use. Because addictive use, you try and create oblivion, you try and lower, you try and obtund your level of consciousness. You want to go blotto. In spiritual use of substances, you actually achieve or attempt to achieve a higher level of consciousness. You don't want to be less connected, you want to be more connected to the tribe, to creation, to yourself. So that the obvious question arises, if the problem is purely genetic, why no addiction before the coming of the Caucasians? Now, I think there's a third way to look at it, which is, doesn't boil down addictions to either a matter of choice or to some genetic disease. Although, the disease model has much to commend it. I mean, the addicted brain is a diseased brain, as I'll mention later. But what we're looking at here is what creates the disease, what causes the disease. And I think there's a third way to look at it. And that third way may be called the biopsychosocial model. Now, biopsychosocial simply means that the biology of the brain, indeed of the entire body, is very much affected throughout the lifetime by psychological and social influences. So you can't separate the biology from a person's life. You can't separate it from a person's life experience. You can't separate the person's biology from the environment, the psychological and social environment in which he or she lives. Nor can you separate the mind and the body. Now, as a physician, I can tell you that medical training still separates the mind from the body and still separates the individual from the environment. And that leaves us no way to understand human beings. Now, let me give you a quick example of what I mean by biopsychosocial. I'll give you two examples, as a matter of fact. Asthma. It's well known now that children whose parents are stressed are much more likely to have asthma. So in a polluted area where children have irritated airways because of the contaminants in the air, it's those children whose parents are most emotionally stressed who are also most likely to have asthma. A number of studies have shown that. Now, the average medical practitioner would have no way of understanding that. And yet, when you actually look at how we treat asthma, we treat it basically with something to open up the airway, which gets narrowed in asthma, and something to suppress the inflammation. The medication that opens up the airway is a copy of adrenaline. The medication that suppresses the inflammation, the steroid, is a copy of cortisol. What you will all know is what adrenaline and cortisol are. Adrenaline and cortisol are the stress hormones made by the adrenal gland. In other words, we're treating asthmatics with stress hormones. But we never ask ourselves, did stress have something to do with the onset of the illness? Now, I'll be talking at my workshop this morning about stress and illness. But what I'm saying is that the emotional states of the parents actually affect the biology of the child. That's how it works. And if you look at the end of life, a study in the New England Journal of Medicine a number of years ago showed that in an elderly couple, when one of them is hospitalized, the other one has a greatly increased risk of death. Why? Because the immune system and the very physiology of the one is very much dependent on the emotional, psychological relationship with the other person. And a number of studies have come out just this week that have shown that people are more lonely or more likely to fall ill and die sooner. Why? Because the alien and biology can't be separated from the psychological social environment. And that's the biopsychosocial perspective. And that's the only way, I believe, that we can scientifically and humanly understand addiction. It's also the only way we can approach the treatment of addiction. Not as a choice or as an isolated disease. Now, from the strict medical perspective, what are addictions all about? Well, these days we talk a lot about dual diagnoses or concurrent diagnoses. In other words, that the addict may have other mental health conditions coexisting with the addiction. Well, to me, that's, I'm going to say it's a no-brainer, but it's a brainer because it all happens in the brain. But it's obvious. Now, I myself was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder at age 53. And that became the subject of my first book, and I'll say it's called Scattered. And I'll say a bit more about that later. Now, how was I treated? I was given Ritalin, and since Ritalin gave me some side effects I didn't like, I was then given dextrodrine. What dextrodrine and Ritalin both do is they elevate the level of a chemical in the brain called dopamine. Dopamine being an important neurotransmitter, essential in motivation and attention. I'll say more about dopamine in a little while. So we give people dextrodrine or Ritalin, stimulants in other words, to elevate dopamine levels. Well, what else elevates dopamine levels? Well, guess what? All the stimulants do. What are the stimulants besides Ritalin and dextrodrine? Well, nicotine is a stimulant. It elevates dopamine levels. Many smokers are self-medicating ADHD, actually. Crystal meth is a stimulant. It elevates dopamine levels. Cocaine is a stimulant. It elevates dopamine levels. Caffeine is a stimulant. It elevates dopamine levels. People that drink 6 or 7 cups of coffee a day, they're self-medicating ADHD. And in the downtown east side, where I worked, wouldn't be unusual for somebody to tell me, hey doc, I don't get it, but when I do crystal meth, instead of getting more hyper, I calm down, I clean my room. And what they're telling me is that they have ADHD undiagnosed and they're self-medicating. In other words, that the stimulant use in a significant minority of stimulant addicts is actually a form of self-medication. They couldn't tell you that, but that's what it is. Number one. Number two, what else do people self-medicate? Well, if you've taken Prozac for depression, as I have, as you know, Prozac and its associated SSRI medications elevate serotonin levels in the brain, serotonin being an important medication in mood control. Well, what else elevates serotonin levels? Guess what? Cocaine does. So guess what? People use cocaine to self-medicate depression. What I'm suggesting is that almost all drug use is, in one way or another, self-medication. Now, saliently, people use opiates to self-medicate post-traumatic stress disorder. If you look at the high rates of opiate addiction amongst the veterans who come back from Afghanistan and Iraq, it's got to do with the medication, the self-medication for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And in a while, I'll talk about why many drug addicts actually do suffer from PTSD. What else do people self-medicate? Well, marijuana calms down the hyperactive brain. People self-medicate ADHD with marijuana. People self-medicate social anxiety, social phobia with alcohol, because alcohol releases their inhibitions and now they're not tongue-tied and shy and backward anymore while under the influence. Cocaine will do the same thing. People self-medicate anxiety disorders with the opiates and with marijuana and with alcohol. So on a strict medical level, if you're only going to look at it medically, you still have to recognize that addiction is not some isolated problem. In fact, what addiction actually is an attempt to solve the problem in a person's life. It may not be a great solution. It's certainly a solution that brings in its wake all kinds of other problems. But from the perspective of the individual who's hooked on a certain drug, that drug helps them live life in a way that's more tolerable than they find without it. So it's not the problem, it's the attempt to solve a problem. And as Dr. Vincent Felitti, an American physician whose work I'll mention in a little while, said that dismissing addictions as bad habits ignores, and self-destructive behaviors ignores their functionality in the life of the addict. So my suggestion is that when we look at addictions and the individual, addicted individual, let's not talk about all the bad stuff that the addiction does. They already know that. And we all know it. Let's ask, what is it doing for them? And how can we perhaps help them attain those qualities without the drug? That's the key question in addiction. Now, to look at it more deeply, beyond the medical diagnostic level, why is it that people use drugs? Well, opiates, and by opiates I mean the drugs that are derived from opium that grows in Afghanistan, the Asian poppy. So heroin, morphine, codeine, or the artificial analogs like Dilaudid, OxyContin, and Percodan, and so on. The opiates, of course, have been known to medical practitioners for over 2,000 years, and they're known because they're the most powerful pain relievers that we have. So the opiates relieve pain. But the opiates don't only relieve pain physically. They also relieve emotional pain. In drugs, in brain scans of human beings, when they're under the observation of a brain scan apparatus, and you subject them to the experience of emotional rejection, the same part of the brain will light up as if you stuck them with a knife. In other words, the emotional pain is experienced in the same part of the brain as physical pain. I'm talking about the suffering aspect of it. I'm talking about the emotional aspect of pain. The anterior cingulate cortex, heavily endowed with opiate receptors. In other words, the opiates are pain relievers, both of physical pain, also of emotional pain. And that means, and by the way, not just the opiates are pain relievers, what is cocaine? Cocaine is a local anesthetic, it's used that way. Marijuana has got analgesic properties. Alcohol, of course, is a painkiller. You know the old expression about somebody who's drunk too much, you say, he's feeling no pain. All the drugs, by diverting the attention from the ordinary consciousness, are attempts to relieve some kind of distress, some kind of emotional pain. And that means that the first question in addiction is not why the addiction, but why the pain. And if you want to understand human beings' pain, you can't look at their genes. You can't look at simply their choices. You have to ask, what happened in their lives? What occurred to that particular individual or to that group of people? And I'll come back to that later as well. Looking a bit more closely at the addicted brain then, why is it that the opiates even work in the brain? Well, how come that a product, a substance derived from a poppy plant in Asia, will have such a powerful impact on human beings around the world? Well, of course, as is well known, the opiates work in the brain and in the body, in the bowels and mucous membranes and elsewhere, Because we have opiate receptors, so receptors being the molecules on the surface of our cells which receive messenger molecules, and then together, if that messenger fits into the receptor, then they influence the cell, telling the DNA what to do, by the way, which is another clue why genes don't determine. Genes are actually turned on and off by the environment. Genes are turned on and off by the environment. And the science of how that occurs is called epigenetics. And it's by means of these messenger and receptor complexes that genes are activated or turned off. In any case, we have receptors for the opiates. Now, why do we have receptors for a substance derived from a plant in Asia? Of course, the answer is that we don't. What we do have receptors for are our own opiates. We have an internal opiate system. And our internal opiates are known by the very well-known name, endorphin. And endorphin means endogenous or internal morphine-like substance. In other words, we have our own internal morphine-like substances. But why do we have them? Why do we have endorphins? Well, obviously, one reason is pain relief. So in the so-called placebo effect, when you give somebody an inert medication, but they have relief, genuine pain relief, they're not imagining it. Simply the belief that they're getting some help releases endorphins in their brains, and that's why they have the genuine opiate pain relief. So the endorphins are pain relievers. That's one of their functions. They have many functions throughout the body, including the intestines, the immune system, and elsewhere. But I'm speaking about their brain functions now. So one function is pain relief, clearly an essential activity. The second function that opiates have is they mediate the experience of pleasure and reward. So whenever you feel elated and happy and joyful, that's because you have endorphin flowing in your brain. Now that's an important quality in human life, without which life is rather unbearable. And they have a third function as well, without which life is not only unbearable, it's impossible. And their third function is, very simply put, love. It's endorphins that mediate the experience of attachment. Now, attachment means the seeking of closeness and proximity with another human being. That's not a luxury. It's not just because country western music needs subjects to think about. It's actually because without attachment, there's no human life. Because the human infant is the least mature, the most helpless, and the most dependent, and stays that way for the longest period of time of any creature in the universe. In other words, without attachment, there's no life. Because we seek closeness and proximity, A, to be taken care of, or B, to take care of. So without attachment, human beings don't survive. You look at the studies connecting loneliness and early death. Not to mention that certainly in the evolutionary phases of human existence, you had to have lots of attachment, lots of connection in order to survive, and we still do. And for the infant, that's an absolute need. Now, it's the endorphins that make possible the attachment relationship between mother and infant, between parent and child. If you take infant mice in the laboratory and you genetically knock out their endorphin receptors, those little infant mice will not cry for their mothers around separation. Now what will that mean in the wild? It will mean their death. Because obviously only the presence of the mother sustains and supports the life of the infant. In short, the opiate addiction arises in the brain circuit. Takes hold of a brain circuit which mediates the essential human qualities of pain relief, pleasure and reward, love and attachment. And as a matter of fact, a sex trade worker, a 27-year-old woman, once said to me that the first time I did heroin, she said, it felt like a warm, soft hug. And that's what many will tell you. Now, you take a human being, any human being, who for whatever reason comes to the conclusion that without this particular substance, he or she will not experience pain relief, pleasure and reward, and a sense of attachment, connection, comfort. How are you going to take that away from them? that substance. Put a sign on the wall saying, just say no. Just say no to love, pain relief, connection, pleasure and reward. Now, that's the opiates. Now, what about the stimulants? Well, in another experiment done in a laboratory within the last year or two, there's a little mouse. You give him some food. He likes it, he chews it, he swallows it, he enjoys it. But if you place the food a few inches away from his nose, he will not budge to eat it. In fact, will starve himself to death rather than eat. Why? Because genetically, they knocked out his dopamine receptors. Now, dopamine being a neurotransmitter, the chemical messenger that induces motivation. And without dopamine, we are listless and we're aimless and we are essentially inactive. Dopamine flows whenever you're curious about something. Dopamine flows whenever you're investigating a novel environment, a novel object. These are all essential for human survival, or any animal survival for that matter. Dopamine flows when you're seeking food or seeking a sexual partner. So it's another essential survival chemical. Imagine, and this is, of course, the substance in the brain that cocaine elevates by 300%, crystal meth by 1200%. Now, take a human being who, for whatever reason, comes to the conclusion, conscious or unconscious, that without this particular substance, they're listless, bored, unmotivated, unvital. How are you going to take that away from them? Put a sign on the wall saying, just say no to vitality, say no to curiosity, say no to motivation. Now, what I'm actually asking is this, you may have noticed. What I'm asking is, who gets susceptible to addiction? Why are some people susceptible to be addicted? It's a myth that drugs are addictive, and that may seem like a surprising statement to you, but, thank you, that may seem like a surprising statement to you, but it's a total myth that drugs are addictive. Drugs are clearly not addictive. In fact, nothing is addictive, or I should say, everything is. Let me give you some examples. Is food addictive? Well, no. Most people eat food without becoming food addicts, but some people, it's a very severe addiction that threatens their lives. Is shopping addictive? Well, some people here it has been, probably. For me, it has been. But not generally. Not to everybody. It's the same with drugs. Is a pack of cards, is gambling addictive? Well, for some people, it's lethally addictive. I mean, they'll lose their existence, their families, everything. But not by itself. In other words, nothing by itself is addictive. Or anything potentially is addictive, it depends on the susceptibility of the individual. And what I'm asking here is, what I'm exploring here is, who's susceptible and why? Now, and I'll come back to that as well. Other brain circuits, and what I'm talking here about the brain circuits that are seized by addiction, and I've mentioned so far the opiate incentive, the opiate reward, pleasure, pain relief and attachment circuits. I've mentioned the dopamine incentive and motivation circuitry, which is activated by all the drugs of abuse, by the way. Or any activity of addiction, by the way, as well. The shopping addict is actually after a chemical change in his brain. That chemical change is caused by the release of dopamine. The dopamine is released because of the activity of gambling. The gambler is a substance addict. The workaholic is a substance addict. The sexaholic is a substance addict. They're all looking to induce chemical changes in their brain through that physical activity. They just don't get the substance from the outside. But there's still the same process. And what I'm really saying to you is that there's a universal addiction process. It doesn't matter what the target is. Is it work, sex, gambling, internet, extreme sports, dangerous physical activities, drugs. It's the universal addiction process that employs the same brain circuits. The same brain circuits will light up in a shopper as will light up in a cocaine addict. The same psychological dynamics and the same spiritual emptiness underneath them all.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with physician and best-selling author Dr. Gabor Mate. His talk, entitled The Hungry Ghost, A Biopsychosocial Perspective on Addiction, From Heroin to Workaholism, was recorded at the Alaska Health Summit on January 15th.
Other brain circuits involved in addiction involve the impulse regulation circuitry. Now, impulses are just our urges to act. So I may see somebody with a muffin on their table, and I may feel hungry, and I want to grab that muffin from their table. That's the impulse, is to grab the muffin. Nothing wrong with me wanting to grab that muffin, but there is something wrong with me actually doing it. And there has to be a circuitry here in the brain that says, okay, you may want to do this, but it's not a good idea. The consequences would not be beneficial for you or anybody else. When you do brain scans on drug addicts, the commonest brain finding is that the part of the brain that regulates impulses does not function. And that's right here where I'm pointing to, the right orbital frontal cortex. And as somebody astutely said, the problem with addiction is not lack of free will, but lack of free won't. The addict has nothing to say no with. And finally, the stress regulation circuitry. Now, stress is an essential human response to a threat. But too much stress, or stress over a long period of time, if our stress circuitry is not regulated well, actually leads to disease. And I'll be talking about that again in my workshop this morning. And I'm here to tell you that whether it's cancer or multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or any other health condition, chronic health condition, the most significant factor in the onset of these conditions is stress. Not genetics, not anything else. Now, in short, we have to have a part of the brain that regulates our stresses. In addicts, that part doesn't work very well. Addicts regulate their stresses through their substances, through their behaviors. In fact, if any of you have had a shopping problem or an eating problem, when are you most likely to indulge in that behavior? It's when you're very stressed. It's your attempt to de-stress. It's the same with addicts. If you look at the literature on addiction, the commonest trigger for addictive relapse is stress. And if you stress laboratory animals or if you use cortisol into their veins, they're much more likely to use cocaine or other substances. So what I'm saying is that certain essential brain circuits just don't function very well in the brains of addicts. I've mentioned all four of them now: stress regulation, impulse regulation, the opiate circuitry, and the dopamine circuitry. The question is, why not? What's wrong with the brains of these people? Because these are the people who are susceptible. You see, as a palliative care physician, I could give high quantities of morphine to people without making them addicted, knowing very well that if we found some other way of dealing with their pain, for example, somebody had severe pain, nerve pain from their spine, and we had to put them on high quantities of opiates, sometimes 3,000 milligrams a day. Now, the average dose of morphine is 5 milligrams every 4 hours, 30 milligrams a day. I've had people on 3,000 milligrams of morphine a day, but you give that person a nerve block so that their pain is solved, you can get them off their morphine really quickly, and they're not seeking it, they're not craving it. So the morphine is not addictive in itself, except to certain individuals. Now, who are those individuals? This is where modern science comes into it, and the sad fact is that what I'm about to tell you is not scientifically controversial at all. There's no debate about it. Everybody in the field knows it, but it's not yet taught in the medical schools, which is that the human brain develops under the impact of the environment. So which circuits develop and which do not depends on the environmental input. You take a small child at birth, an infant, with perfectly good eyes and perfectly good genes, you put him in a dark room for 5 years, he'll be blind thereafter for the rest of his life. Why? Because the circuitry of vision requires light waves for its development. The 30 or so circuits that together make up the visual apparatus require the input of light waves. And the critical period is the first 5 years. So if that kid does not see light, even the circuits that were present at birth will atrophy and die, and new ones will not develop. And that same is true of many other essential brain circuits. Now, the human brain is especially susceptible to the environment. Why is the human brain especially susceptible? Well, just look at us compared to a horse. The horse can run on the first day of life. In other words, it attains a level of muscle strength, neurological control, balance, and visual acuity that the human being does not reach until 18 or 24 months, meaning that the horse at the moment of birth is a year and a half to 2 years ahead of us in terms of brain development. Now, why is that? That has to do with evolution. And evolution, of course, meant that the human brain got larger and larger because we began to use our forepaws as hands and our digits as fingers, and that meant a larger brain to plan and control and manipulate all those functions. So a larger head. In order to make use of the hands, of course, we have to walk on two legs. When we walk on two legs, the pelvis gets narrower because a narrower pelvis favors a two-legged stance. You can't walk on two legs with the pelvis of a horse. So if we walk on two legs, the pelvis gets narrower, the head gets larger. So if any of you have given birth or seen a birth, you know what the punchline is. The punchline is that if we were born any later, we wouldn't be. Already at 9 months of gestation, the head is the largest part of the body. If it was any larger, it wouldn't make it through the birth canal. So that means that the evolutionary bargain was that you can have a large head and sophisticated cerebral apparatus and all kinds of activities, but you're going to have to be born prematurely and you're going to have to develop on the outside where things are not necessarily as safe as in the uterus, in the relative safety of the womb. I say relative safety of the womb because already what happens in pregnancy to the woman has an impact on the child. So, in studies of women who are abused during pregnancy by their partners, their placenta at birth will have larger quantities, of course, of the stress hormone cortisol, and cortisol shrinks important brain structures and interferes with nervous development. No wonder, then, that the children of abused women who are abused in pregnancy are more likely to have behavior and developmental problems that predispose them to addictions. And in laboratory studies, if you stress pregnant animals, their offspring as adults are more likely to soothe themselves with cocaine and alcohol. So already what happens in pregnancy has a huge impact. After birth, the human brain is the only one that for a while develops at the same rate inside the uterus as it did outside the uterus. Outside the uterus as it did on the inside. There are times in the first year of life when every second in that space of time, many millions of connections are being made every second. By the end of the third year of life, the human brain is 90% adult size, the body 18% adult size. So it's a really crucial period, early childhood, for development. And the point is that just as the stimulation of light waves is necessary for the development of the visual circuitry of the brain, in the same way, the impulse regulation, stress regulation, the attachment, reward circuitry, the incentive circuitry also needs the right environment. And that environment primarily is the psychological and social environment. And the necessary condition for the optimal development of these crucial brain circuits is the presence of non-stressed, non-depressed, emotionally available, consistently available, attuned parenting caregivers. In other words, the necessary condition for these essential brain circuits, again, for the physiological development, for the biochemical development, is the presence of attuned, non-stressed, non-depressed, emotionally and consistently available parenting caregivers. Anything that interferes with the parents' ability to provide those conditions for their children may result in the suboptimal development of those children's brains, of those brain circuits. At the University of Washington, they looked at EEGs, electroencephalograms, of the brains of six-month-old infants whose mothers had postpartum depression. Now, depressed mothers don't love their kids any less. They're not less devoted. They don't try any less hard to look after the kids' needs, but they can't attune with the kids' emotional needs. Well, try this, they might. If you look at the EEGs of 6-month-old infants whose mother has postpartum depression and compare them to the EEGs of infants whose mothers were not depressed, you can tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and who isn't. In other words, the electrical circuitry of the child's brain is programmed by the emotional, psycho-emotional relationship with the mother, biopsychosocial. Dopamine. You can take infant monkeys, measure their dopamine levels, and then separate them from their mothers. And within a week, their dopamine levels have diminished because of separation from mother. You can wean rats 1 week early. They're more likely to use cocaine and alcohol when they grow up. Now, if you look at what's happening to children in North America right now, in the United States, there are 3 million kids who are receiving stimulant medications for ADHD. The numbers are going up and up and up. In Canada, the number of prescriptions for stimulant medications have gone up 43% in the last 5 years. The number of all kinds of diagnoses, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorders, I could give you a whole day just on child stuff. Conduct disorders, autism, of course, behavior problems of all, they're going up and up and up. We're medicating more and more kids. In your country, there are 500,000 children at least who are receiving antipsychotic medications, not because they're psychotic, because it's the only way we've come to find that we can control their behaviors. And what we have now is this massive social experiment in the chemical control of children's brains. And we diagnose them with diseases. They don't have diseases. You know what they have? They lack the conditions for healthy development. They have developmental problems because the parent, the environment, was too stressed. Not as the fault of the parent, but because the natural nurturing environment, the clan, the tribe, the village, the community, the extended family, the neighborhood, they have all been destroyed. And the parents are so stressed. And in your country, you have a maternal leave of 6 weeks. Children are not with their parents anymore. Under such conditions, what do we expect? But that their brains would be affected. Naturally, of course, the burden of this maldevelopment falls most heavily on people that are economically or socially or racially disadvantaged. That's just how it goes. Strangely enough, they're the same people we find in our jails 20 years later. Now, if you actually look at the life stories of drug addicts, in the downtown east side of Vancouver, where I worked for 12 years, I did not have a single female patient who had not been sexually abused as a child. Not one, not even by accident. Well, I should say, there was one woman who said she had not been. Many of the men had been traumatized, if not sexually, as many of them had been, then physically abandoned, neglected, beaten, all kinds of things. Under such conditions, the brain does not develop the way it ought to. Number one. Number two, people develop post-traumatic stress. Number three, they have pain. They have tremendous emotional and physical pain as well, but above all emotional pain, tremendous self-loathing. Because the traumatized child comes to the conclusion that if this is the way the world is treating me, there's something wrong with me. It's that they're trying to get away from. That's why they're addicted. That's why their brains are susceptible for the addictive substances, for the potentially addictive substances. Is that just my personal opinion and observation? Large-scale population studies in the United States have shown that for each adverse childhood experience, the risk of addiction goes up exponentially. And I've been to Alaska before. In fact, the last time I was here, I spoke at a conference with Dr. Vincent Felitti, who I mentioned before. And Dr. Felitti is one of the main investigators of the well-known, or by now should be well-known, adverse childhood experiences studies. So let me actually ask you, would you please raise your hands? How many of you have learned about the adverse childhood experiences studies? I'm gratified to see that. Many times I don't see this many hands. But Dr. Felitti's studies in California showed that for each adverse childhood experience, the risk of illness of all kinds goes up. What's an adverse childhood experience? Well, physical, sexual, or emotional abuse. A parent being addicted. Violence in the family. A parent beating another. A parent being jailed. Mental illness in the family. A rancorous divorce. The death of a parent. In other words, anything that interferes with those conditions that I told you were necessary. And so for each of these conditions, if a child has had one, the risk of addiction is so much. If you said two, the risk multiplies. By the time a male child had six of these adverse childhood experiences, the risk of him being an injection using substance addict is 4,600%, 46 times more acute than that of a male child with no such experiences. We're not talking about genetics. We're talking about life experience. Life experience as it affects the brains of the individual and the emotional makeup of the individual. And in the spiritual sense, also the sense of isolation from the universe, the despair, the emptiness that anybody with addiction experiences. Now, I could talk about my own addictive behaviors. I've had them, not to substances, but certainly to work, and certainly to a certain kind of shopping. And I can tell you that in every way, it has similar features to the drug addict. Not as severe, of course, and not nearly so dire in its consequences, but in terms of the compulsivity of it, the compulsion, the inability to wait for the next one, the need to get more and more, the shame and the lying that follows from it, the negative impact on family life and relationships. Addictions are never benign, I should say. My definition of addiction is any behavior, substance-related or not, that is associated with craving, temporary relief, pleasure, and negative consequences, and you're not able to give it up. That's what an addiction is. So whether it's to shopping or to sex or whatever it is it compulsive? Does it give you temporary relief, pleasure? Does it have negative consequences? Are you able to give it up? If you're not, it's an addiction. And again, what I'm saying to you is that the addiction process, no matter what the target of the addiction is the same. So the DSM keeps coming up with new categories of addiction, as if they're finding new diseases. They're not finding new diseases. What they're finding is new targets for the universal addiction process. Now, I'd like to read you a little bit more from my book. Detective Sergeant Paul Gillespie, head of Toronto Sex Crimes Unit, rescued children from purveyors of internet pornography. As the Globe and Mail being Canada's national newspaper, reported on his retirement from police work, 6 years at that job had not inured him to the horrors he witnessed. Quote, Paul Gillespie still can't get used to the sounds of crying and pain in the graphic videos of children being raped and molested. That he has seen all too often on the web. It's beyond horrible to listen to the soundtracks of these movies, said Canada's best-known child porn cop. But it is the silent images of desolate children that tear most at his heart. They're not screaming, just accepting, he said, of the infants captured in these pictures. They have dead eyes. You can tell that their spirit is broken. That's their life. Now, there's 2 points I'd like to make here. One is that this very compassionate and dedicated policeman really did a lot to rescue kids from abusers. But the question I want to ask you is, if he had transferred to the drug squad, who do you think he'd be chasing in the streets? It's the same kids that he wasn't able to rescue 20 years earlier. Because according to all the scientific literature, they're the ones who become the drug addicts. So you can see the contradiction. We do our best to rescue kids from horror. And when we're unable to do so, we end up punishing them. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk was the world's leading trauma expert, psychiatry professor at Boston University. He has said that 100% of the inmates of the criminal justice system in the U.S. are traumatized children. So that's the first point. The second point is that, as I told you, stress is the biggest factor in causing addictive relapse. So exactly what are we doing in a system that punishes and ostracizes and marginalizes people? We're stressing them. We're making sure that they stay addicted. That's the second point. The third point, those dead eyes. Why do a child's eyes go dead? And what is that all about? It's a defense mechanism. It's a defense mechanism. The brain has only so many ways it can protect you. Now, if I were to be threatening or abusive or to you right now or stressing you somehow, you'd have three healthy options. One would be to just stand up and just assert yourself and say, stop it. The other would be to walk out that door. The door's open. The third, if you couldn't do that, given that there's hundreds of people here in the room with you, you could just ask for help. But what does the brain do when you can't escape, fight back, or ask for help? Well, the brain is reduced to some kind of a stratagem to help you cope with the stress by diminishing your awareness of it. So one of them is to shut down your emotions. So you're going through the experience, but you're no longer feeling it. That's why the eyes go dead. That helps you protect you in the long term. So in the short term, but in the long term, that same defense mechanism then emotionally deadens you, makes your life unbearable, and stops your emotional growth. Because for growth, you need vulnerability. So the brain can protect you from feeling vulnerable. It can't protect. Vulnerability is from the Latin word vulnerare, to wound. As human beings, we're all fundamentally vulnerable from conception until death. There's nothing the brain can do to protect you from being vulnerable. What the brain can do is protect you from the awareness of vulnerability when that's too much to bear. These brain mechanisms that protect you from vulnerability in childhood then become sources of pathology later on. So when you shut down emotionally, you stop growing. Why? Because growth demands vulnerability. A tree doesn't grow where it's hard and thick. A tree grows where it's soft and green and vulnerable. A crustacean animal, like a crab, cannot grow inside a hard shell. If it's going to grow, it has to make itself soft and vulnerable. Same with human emotional growth. And that means that people that are hurt early stay immature until they get to feel safe, and then they can start growing again. Which means that the way to help people is to give them a sense of safety and love and connection. Not punishment, just the opposite is what they need. Because the good news is that the brain, unlike with vision, can develop new circuits, and emotional development and growth can take place later on, but it needs the right conditions. Now, another form of self-defense is just to tune out. All these kids that are being diagnosed with ADHD, you know what it's all about? What it's all about is that the parents were so stressed, and since the child absorbs the stress of the parent, the way they protected themselves was to tune out. When did they tune out? When the brain was developing. The tuning out becomes programmed into the brain. Then they're diagnosed with ADHD and given the dopamine medication because the dopamine circuits didn't develop. And we think we have a disease. We don't. We have a developmental problem based on an early defense against stress. Well, in a short talk of an hour duration, I can't give you all the ways that I would suggest that we need to work with addicts. But what I can tell you is that addiction is, again, their compensation for life experience. And I wouldn't be complete without mentioning, of course, the historical experience of Aboriginal peoples in North America, the history of overt genocide, oppression, dislocation, loss of lands, livelihood, the suppression of their spiritual ways, and then in Canada, and I think also in the U.S., I don't know to what extent in your country, but then the abduction of Native children away from their families, their forced enrollment in residential schools over many, many generations, the determined effort to take the Indian out of the Indian by destroying their culture and, of course, their physical and sexual abuse over multiple generations. Then we have this huge addiction problem in those populations, and we think there's the drunken Indian and there's the genetic problem. Nothing genetic about it. And of course, what happens is when people are traumatized, they pass on their trauma to their kids. Not deliberately. It's just what happens. And especially when over generations, you've destroyed those families. Now, I was traumatized as an infant. I was a Jewish infant in Budapest, Hungary, in the Second World War, in my first year of life. And I know that many of my tendencies go back to that first year of my life. And I know that I passed some of that on to my kids. I didn't mean to. But as adults, they have to deal with what happened to me as an infant. Well, same thing happens in North America or to many other people over generations and generations and generations. So, in approaching addictions, therefore, we have to A, understand that it's not anybody's conscious choice. They're not to be blamed for it. B, it's their particular attempt to deal with suffering. Keith Richards, the Rolling Stone guitarist, who, as you know, was a heroin addict, said in his biography that his heroin habit was an attempt for oblivion. Why would people want oblivion? It's because the life that they have, the consciousness that they have, the experience they have of themselves is intolerable. Now, we can approach this with punitive, critical, judgmental, controlling approaches. Or we can approach it with understanding, with an endeavor to know the science behind it, and with really anybody who works with people and has a heart, an open heart, will tell you is that what people need is compassion. Because as a spiritual teacher said, only when compassion is present will people allow themselves to see the truth. And that means that when the addicted client is emotionally immature, of course they are. They never had the conditions to mature. No point telling them, you're immature. Give them the conditions that they can mature in. The brain, once it's become addicted, is a diseased organ. You can do brain scans. You can see that there's a loss of white matter and gray matter, and circuits are not working. Well, the brain can regenerate, thank God, in many, many, many ways over time, but people need patience, they need the right conditions. And we have to be able to accept relapse, because relapse happens in a chronic disease like rheumatoid arthritis. Why wouldn't it happen in addiction? Do we then punish the person for relapsing, or do we then go back and give them the support that they need? Look, I will stop here for questions, and my books are available on the site here afterwards. I'm happy to sign them for you. But let me just finish with this observation that the punitive and controlling and scientifically uninformed approach that we have to addiction not only hurts the addict, it also hurts us as a society. It makes us less human. And it doesn't allow us to bring families together, and it inhibits our capacity to build community. So I would suggest that if we developed a healthy, science-based and heart-based response to addiction, we would not only doing a much better job with healing addicts, we'd also have a more livable society. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with physician and best-selling author Dr. Gabor Mate. His talk, entitled The Hungry Ghost, A Biopsychosocial Perspective on Addiction, From Heroin to Workaholism, was recorded at the Alaska Health Summit on January 15, 2013. Go to alaskapublic.org to listen to Dr. Mate's interview with Dr. Thad Woodard on KSKA's Line 1 Your Health Connection back in January. Next week on Addressing Alaskans, horse dancing over the fences of tradition, Korea, YouTube, and the marketing of culture in the 21st century. Recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council, hear from Dr. Jocelyn Clark, Tuesday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Yes, you heard right. Addressing Alaskans moves to Tuesdays starting next week. Tune in at the same time, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. for Addressing Alaskans, every Tuesday starting next week. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.